The opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of the management or staff of Radio Kingston, WKNY. AM 1490, FM 1079, Kingston, New York.
Give myself to you completely.
Good morning. It is 10 a.m. on Saturday, and so that means it's time for some Nature Nuggets. And I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland. And this program is all about exploring the natural world around us. And if you're like me, and feeling the weight of the darkness of the, you know, political human moment, I invite you to take a deep breath and look around and go outside, because the biggest, relief that I can find from the chaos of our moment is the gift of the natural world. And we're so lucky being here in the Hudson Valley, surrounded by the Catskills and the tidal estuary of the Hudson River, that we have such a vibrant, series of ecosystems and such lush biodiversity. And the whole world is really waking up around us. Last week, when I walked to the studio, I had a big coat on. It was sort of a wintry mix of snow and ice. And today, the forecast is for 85 degrees, 84 degrees, I think, which is a bit of a spring whiplash of an experience, but I'm not mad about it. And so with this program, as a thesis, what we talk about is the fact that people won't fight for what they don't love, and they can't love what they don't know. And so what we hope to do for an hour every Saturday is explore some facet of the natural world that might help you understand what you're seeing when you walk outside a little bit deeper. And so the way we do that is we bring on guests every week who have dedicated their lives to developing an expertise of some form or another in the natural world. So we have scientists and conservationists and authors and birders and artists and folks who, can be our guides and help tell us some stories that can inform our own experience when we do go outside. And so I'm very excited about today's guest, who I will introduce in just a moment. But before I do that, I am going to start with a segment, as we do every week, called Who's About Town. And Who's About Town is a bit like the society pages of a small town newspaper, except we're talking about a little snapshot of the more than human world. So as I mentioned, today is the warmest day yet of 2025. So, here we go. And as we've, if you've even walked out of your house this last week, you can't deny the signs of spring all around us. The forsythia are blooming bright yellow everywhere you look. The magnolias are just about to be in full bloom. The fruit trees are in full bloom in many cases. And if you go into the forest, you'll see that the spring ephemerals are happening. And the spring ephemerals are a wonderful phenomenon that we have in early spring in the ecosystems around us here. And these are native wildflowers that have been storing their carbohydrates and their energy underground in their roots and rhizomes. And this is their time of year to shine. And so they take advantage of the fact that the leaves of the forests have not come in yet. And that means that the sunshine is reaching the forest floor. And so I just had a wonderful walk at Black Creek, a wonderful scenic Hudson Preserve just south of us here from Kingston. And we saw the full suite of spring ephemerals is now in effect. So that means Dutchman's breeches, which are incredible architecture of a flower, beautiful, strange looking, lovely little flower. The red trillium are out. The trout lilies are out. We also saw a Virginia saxifrage. It's a little white flower. The bloodroot. So lots of different, and these are, as their name suggests, these are fleeting moments in the season that you can see these flowers. So now is the time to get out and see them. Yesterday, I also took a walk down to the lighthouse outside of Socrates and saw that the spice bush is in full bloom. So, you know, this is a wonderful time to get outside and take advantage of the season. And of course, for me as a birder, this is also, you know, already becoming, the, you know, one of the most exciting times of the year, but about to be the most exciting time of the year because the neotropical migration is in effect. Not quite yet, but we're seeing signs of it. The swallows have arrived. We saw a pair of kestrels on our walk this last couple days. Kestrels are a wonderful little falcon, a tiny little bird, and they just have beautiful plumage, and they're just great because, you know, they're hardly bigger than a robin. In fact, they might not be, but they take themselves just as seriously as a big falcon does, except I think about 3/4 of their food source is, you know, insects, and they'll go after a grasshopper, or, you know, if they get a mouse, they're very happy about it. But if you look around now, you'll see them being very active. Also saw just on the river yesterday double-crested cormorants, which are, you know, a beautiful black diving bird. And most of the year, you could question why they're called a double-crested cormorant, but this is the time where that is not in question. They have this wonderful, their breeding plumage is these kind of elaborate horns that they develop. And, you know, you also hear, if you open your window right now, even if you're here in Midtown Kingston, you'll hear the cardinals in full song, the robins, the titmice, the Carolina wrens. And so these are our resident birds that didn't necessarily migrate, but they have an advantage over the migrants because they have been here all winter, and they're able to get started with their mating rituals and with their nest building before the, you know, the birds that have to fly thousands of miles. But, you know, I really take a lot of joy this time of year in thinking about the fact that there are a billion beaks pointed north right now. These, the warblers and the orioles and the grosbeaks are all moving north. They're crossing the Gulf of Mexico right now, and they're coming up through the continent, and they're about to arrive. And if you, you know, just take a second and think about that process of migration. These birds have to do a lot. They have to store up energy and fat before they make that huge trip. And they actually go through incredible physiological changes. Their gonads shrink down to tiny sizes, and they you know, they fly all, thousands of miles under the cover of darkness, and then when they arrive, they are flooded with hormones and they go just a little bit crazy. And so there's a phenomenon where the males often arrive slightly before the females, and they do this so that they can get busy. They can start to establish a territory. They can get to learn their own song, because they do have to kind of relearn it a little bit each year. So they want to do some practicing. So they're flooded with hormones. And when they arrive, you know, this is again, largely before the trees have leafed out, and they're more easy to observe, and they're more active than. And so, you know, there's a couple weeks in May that if you're, you know, even if you're not a regular birder, it's a very exciting time because they're super active. They're sorting themselves out, and those males really want to have something to show for themselves when the females arrive. They want to show that they have a beautiful song, and that they're robust and healthy, and that they can provide food for a nest, and they can defend their territories. And so, you know, there's a bit of a predictable procession of arrivals. So we're starting to see signs. We have among the warblers, which we have like 26 species that can pass through here in migration in spring. But there's a few, the pine warblers, the palm warblers, the Orange Crown Warblers. Those are our first wave of arrivals. And I've been looking at eBird and seeing that some of those are already being observed, but just a handful, one here, one there, but it's about to become a flood. And something I saw this last week at my house is that our cardinals are going crazy. You know, they're driven a little bit mad by this flush of hormones, and it can lead them to do some ridiculous looking things. And one of those is fighting in the rearview mirrors or the side mirrors of cars. And that's because, you know, these birds for millions of years never had such a thing as a mirror. And so they can look a bit bird-brained, you know, fighting against themselves. But that's because they are just so programmed if they see, you know, another male in their territory to fend him off. And so when they see their own reflection, they can, you know, so if you see that happening, I don't know, maybe put a little, you know, a towel or a shirt over your mirror so that they don't lose too much energy doing that. I'll do a proper introduction in a moment, but we have Ethan Tapper joining us from Vermont. And Ethan, I wanted to invite you to share, you know, a couple observations that you may have had about the emergence of spring.
You're just getting me so excited. I mean, it's so I've always, you know, always since I've been paying attention, I guess would be more accurate. Really love the spring ephemeral wildflowers. And I think, you know, when I first got into the woods, being interested in the woods, which was actually happened to me kind of late, like in my late teens, I really was in this primitive skills community. And so I was really interested in foraging. And that sort of was a gateway where that got me into like ramps. And then that got me into ephemerals in the woods. So I've been just obsessed with ephemerals for a long time. The more I learn about them, the more excited I get. And I write about them a lot in my book, actually, which we'll talk about, I'm sure, later. And so I'm really interested in them. But then really, during the pandemic, I became a birder. And when those birds, you know, when you start to get into them, my gosh, they get you. And so I was just, you're talking about all these birds, and it's like, it honestly is... So the whole thing is so miraculous and so exciting that it makes me want to cry.
It's just
incredible. And the first time that you witness, you know, the flood, like when that dropout happens and suddenly one day there are dozens of new species of birds that are just there. It's just overwhelming. It's so incredible. So the new ones I heard, I saw my first northern flicker this morning.
Mm.
I heard a pine warbler yesterday. Pine warblers are very frustrating because they are very beautiful and they are very, very, very hard to see because they're always way up in pine trees. I've been hearing a lot of brown creepers. We're a little bit behind you all. Brown creepers, saying, I posted a video to my social media about juncos this morning. We're saying bye to the juncos here as they fly north pretty soon. But we're still, I looked at Birdcast this morning, which is this website that allows you to track the spring migration, tell you how many birds are migrating and where they're migrating, and saw that there's 136 million birds in motion, either, I guess, tonight. But we know that in a week or two, it's going to be well over 300 million birds are going to be in flight. And it's just, you see that, you know, they have a heat map on there, so you can see that they're sort of in that southern U.S., but they're coming. And it's just such a joyous thing.
Absolutely. Well, I love you brought up Birdcast because that is a technology that, you know, didn't exist when I started being a birder decades ago. But now they're able to use, yeah, advanced radar technology and track the migration in real time. And so if you go onto, it's called birdcast.info is the website that Ethan's referring to. And they tell you, you know, what species are moving, what elevation they're flying at, what numbers they're in. It's really quite incredible. And yeah, it's a natural phenomenon, really unparalleled. And one of the things I love to think about is how, you know, these are birds that are coming from the tropical rainforests of South America in many cases, but they were born here. You know, these are birds that are, they were born here, and they return in some cases to the actual tree where they were from. You know, orioles are famous for that because they build kind of an elaborate hanging nest. And so, you know, the fact that they can, cross continents and then return to the tree that they were born in is just remarkable. And, you know, it's come to be understood that they're using so many different tools of navigation to do that. And they've even found that there is a little bit of magnetite in the eyeballs of some of these birds that they think allows them to actually see the electromagnetic lines of the planet so that they can, track that. And so they also use the stars. And so oftentimes if it's a cloudy night, they'll land and they'll wait till it clears and then they'll go back into the air. So they're using landforms, they're using stars, they're using electromagnetic fields. And even when they get close, they say that they use smells and then, milestones like mountains and forests along the way. So just an incredible thing. You know, you look at these little birds and you can take for granted. But it's incredibly marvelous.
It's one of the wonders of the world.
Indeed.
It truly is. It's a globally incredible phenomenon, this migration occurs and we get to witness it. I know it's like, if you don't think about it, you're just like, yesterday there weren't birds here, today there are all these other birds. And then if you really think about it, it's just a wonder, truly.
It really is. And you don't have to go, deep into the woods to observe it. You know, just here in your backyard in Midtown Kingston, one of the wonderful things about migration is that all bets are off. The habitat that you usually have to go to find a specific bird, in the midst of migration, it doesn't matter. You could almost see anything anywhere. And so something that might be specific to the boreal forests of Canada or to, a habitat that you don't live in, may well end up in your backyard in the next couple weeks. And and because they're hungry, they're tired, they often are much easier to observe because they just don't have the energy to be subversive. they present themselves because they need to find food and they just need to take a rest. It's a great time. And I love that you said that you became a birder during the pandemic. I think that's a widespread phenomenon. A lot of people took to birding then. I think we're seeing a big influx of folks that, maybe hadn't paid as close of attention before, but now they do, and it is addictive.
And I think a part of that too, you mentioned Birdcast, or we mentioned Birdcast, and another technology is that Merlin Bird ID app, which I think some, more old school birders, they don't love the idea that you can ID a bird with an app, but I think it's how you use it, right? So for me, I work in the woods, and what the experience that I had trying to learn birds before that app existed was I would hear something and then there would be no one there to affirm what I had heard. And so it made it very difficult to learn. So what I tell people to use is I advise people to starting now, because right now it's just a few new birds, and far fewer birds than they're going to be in a few weeks. So starting now, to just go sit outside with the app on for even 5 minutes, as early as you can stand it in the morning, like 7 o'clock hour is fine, in a park or on your porch or whatever, and then use the app so that you don't have to use the app. Like use it as a learning tool. Don't just like hold it up and then look at what it says and be like, cool. Because also, it's neat to also think birds are cool, but I think really the best usage of the app is using it like a bird guide, right? It's a reference tool. And so that if that app didn't exist, I wouldn't be a birder right now. The reason that I'm a birder is because I had the ability to use that as a learning tool. And then that hooked me. And now, I get into all the other stuff, the hanging out with other birders, being part of my local Audubon organization. And now I'm an Audubon endorsed forester and a bird friendly Audubon bird friendly sugar maker. And, all these other things, but none of that would have been possible if I hadn't been able to have that.
Wow, I love that you brought that up. And if anybody, you know, is wondering what he's referring to, Merlin is a free app. If you have a smartphone, you can download it for free. And, you know, here in New York, up in Ithaca, we have really the world's probably premier scientific, entity that studies birds, the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. And this is it's sort of Shazam for birds. And I, you know, as a lifelong birder, you know, I spent years developing the skill of identifying birds by sound. And when you go outside, you realize about 80% of birding really is auditory. You hear far, far more birds than you're going to be able to see with your eyes. And so I was one of those stubborn old school birders in the beginning who kind of thought, oh, geez, you know, here now anybody, I have this unique, you know, skill I spent years developing. And now anybody with a cell phone, you know, can do it. But I've gotten over that. And it really is kind of magical. So I would encourage folks, you know, you can download it. As I said, it's for free. And if you just turn it on and point your phone at the forest or at your yard, wherever you are, you can just see them appear and it will light up with a picture and the name of the birds that are singing or calling. And just to make a quick little explanation, you know, birds make a lot of sounds and they do that throughout the year, but there's a big distinction to be made between calls and songs. And so calls are what we've been hearing all winter. And those are vocalizations that birds make to stay in touch with each other, to keep the flock together, to warn of danger, lots of different reasons that birds make calls. But songs in particular are largely, and there's always exceptions to every rule in nature, but songs are basically sung in spring by males. And songs exist largely, again, this is generalization, to tell other males, hey, this spot is taken. This is my territory. If you come here, we're gonna fight. And then it also advertises to females, I'm robust. I'm ready to go. Come hang out with me. I'll build you a nest. And so it's a very specific phenomenon to spring, and that's where they have these elaborate specific songs, and that's what is developing right now. Okay, I'm really looking forward to introducing Ethan deeper and diving into the conversation we're going to have. But before we do that, we are going to take a quick break to hear some words from the community.
Hi, I'm Daniel Woodham from the Ulster Immigrant Defense Network. We've been hearing a lot about knowing your rights lately. It means all people living in this country, including immigrants, have basic rights granted by the U.S. Constitution. Here's how to protect yourself at home. If anyone you suspect is ICE comes to your door, don't let them in. Ask to see an ID and a warrant signed by a judge. Have them slip it under the door or show it in the window, but don't open the door. ICE is counting on you not knowing that they need a judicial warrant to enter your home. Show them that you know your rights. If ICE doesn't have a warrant signed by a judge, you can say, I do not want to speak to you. Please leave. There are also Know Your Rights workshops and presentations in the community for immigrants and their allies. To get information on the workshops, click Know Your Rights at ulsterimmigrantdefensenetwork.org.
Top of the day to you. Hi, I'm Anna Brett.
And I'm Ken Brett. And we're inviting you to join us every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. for the Irish Show.
We're brought to you by the men and women of the Ancient Order of Hibernians.
Tune in to hear the best of Irish music through the ages, from lively dance tunes to jigs and reels to sentimental two-step.
We'll also give you the latest updates on Irish and Irish-American activities in the Hudson Valley.
You'll hear about the birthdays of our listeners as well as other important events in their lives.
And you'll laugh and or cry at our collection of Irish proverbs every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. on Radio Kingston.
AM 1490.
FM 107.9.
And anytime at radiokingston.org.
In honor of Earth Day, Circle of Friends for the Dying is hosting the Spirit of Green Burial at Jim and Lisa's Circle Home, Tuesday, April 22nd. Hudson Valley author and farmer Suzanne Kelly will lead a conversation about the green burial movement. Her book, Greening Death, Reclaiming Burial Practices and Restoring Our Ties to the Earth, traces the philosophical and historical origins of this movement. which seeks to remove chemicals and pollutants from funeral and burial practices, as well as restore the human relationship with nature. Admission is free, but RSVPs are requested, and donations are graciously accepted. The Spirit of Green Burial, Tuesday, April 22nd, from 4 to 5:30 p.m. at Jim and Lisa's Circle Home, 100 Wirtz Street in Kingston. For more information, circlehome.org. So before we join this conversation, I'm going to take host prerogative and share a couple of important kind of pieces of local information. I'm looking at two flyers that have been being distributed through Midtown right now. And one is from Midtown Thriving, and they are inviting the community to weigh in about three different properties that the city is making plans for. So these are industrial sites and other kind of unutilized spaces that are right here in Midtown, and they want community input about what should be done with these places. Excuse me. So May 3rd, starting at 10 a.m., there's going to be a series of in-person events where you're welcome to come down. One of the sites is on Field Court, one's on Thomas Street, and one's on Smith Avenue. And so they will start at 10 a.m. and go till about 4 p.m. through a series of these sites. So if you want to learn more about how to engage in this process, you can go to Midtown Thriving, which is at engagekingston.com, and check that out if you want to help shape what the future of our neighborhood is going to look like. And the other one, somewhat related, is about the future of the Midtown Linear Park. And so specifically, this is the area between Down Street and past O'Neill to Cornell Street. And this already is a beautiful walkway, but right now it's sort of just a blank canvas with lawn and a couple trees. But they're looking to develop it into something else. And they are asking for community input. So this is going to be a multi-month process. It's already begun, and it will lead through October of this year. And so they're asking the community to be engaged. And this is a project of Ulster County. And so I'm not going to read the whole URL because it's too long to read. But if you Google Ulster County Midtown Linear Park, you'll come to the place. There's a survey you can do. And then there will also be in-person events that you can attend. Okay, well, you've already been hearing a little bit of the enthusiasm of our guest today, Ethan Tapper. Ethan is a forester, an author, a birder, a hunter, and a natural historian from Vermont, and he's the author of a recently published book titled How to Love a Forest, The Bittersweet Work of Tending to a Changing World. Ethan has been recognized as a thought leader and a disruptor in the forestry and conservation community of the Northeastern United States and beyond, and he has won multiple regional and national awards for his work. And Ethan runs a consulting business for forestry called Bear Island Forestry, and he's a regular contributor to Northern Woodlands Magazine, as well as a variety of other publications, and a digital creator with tens of thousands of followers on Instagram, YouTube, TikTok, and Facebook. His handle on those platforms is at How to Love a Forest. And in his personal life, Ethan works, writes, hunts, and birds at Bear Island, his 175-acre working forest, homestead, orchard, and sugarbush, works towards a graduate degree at the University of Vermont, and plays in a 10-piece punk band, The Bubs. So, Ethan, I'm so delighted that you've taken the time to join us today. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So before we get into your work that you're doing now, you know, I'd love to start with just a little bit of your personal story of how you, you know, the path that led you to become a forester and a conservationist. If there was a particular landscape that inspired you in your youth or spark experiences that led you to pursue this path.
Sure. Yeah. So, you know, I've had this experience of since How to Love a Forest came out in September, gotten to talk to, you know, all kinds of people about it. And one of the funny things is that I sort of have gotten to develop my own like origin story, you know, like a superhero. And the funny thing about mine is I feel like when I hear the stories of these, you know, people that I admire, biologists, ecologists, these nature writers, they're always like, this was always what I was interested in. This is always what I knew I wanted to do. I always knew that I wanted to work in the woods. And that wasn't my experience at all. I grew up in a rural community in southeastern Vermont, a village called Saxon's River, which is like 300 people surrounded by forests. But what I really wanted to do was to get out of there. And I actually remember, telling somebody my junior year of high school, I was like, I don't know where I'm going to go to college, but I know where I'm not going to go. And that's the University of Vermont, because everybody goes there and I'm getting out of here. I ended up getting a scholarship to University of Vermont, and I was like, I'll just do it anyway. But once I got there, I didn't know what I wanted to study. And what happened was my high school girlfriend, this like first big love of my life, she ended up going on this expedition with this wilderness program. It was like this 5-month expedition. And when she returned, she had had this life-changing experience. And I had not. I'd just been in a dorm room doing what 19-year-olds do. And we weren't connecting, and I thought we were going to break up. And so I said, well, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going on a wilderness expedition. And the next one left in 2 weeks, a very impulsive decision. It was a 6-month expedition where we skied north for 3 months, built a canoe and canoe back down. And, you know, in retrospect, I did this for no reason. That relationship didn't work out. But after that, all I wanted to do was just be in the woods. And I worked as a wilderness guide. I lived in this like uninsulated yurt in the woods of Maine with a fir bough floor for a year. And then I got this letter from the University of Vermont that told me that I had to come back or I was going to lose my scholarship. And so when I went back, I went back to study forestry, which is something that I literally did not know what it was, but it just had the word forest in it. So I said, well, just try that. And I ended up, you know, loving it. And there's a lot that I love about it that we can talk about more if you want to. But I basically, it was an interesting experience, really, because the experience that I had and that I think really informed the ideas that became How to Love a Forest and the ideas I express on my social media and elsewhere. You know, I was this wilderness guide and I had this like really close relationship with these ecosystems. And, you know, I was also young and idealistic. And I was like, this feeling that I have, this relationship that I have must be the true expression of like what our most evolved, best relationship with ecosystems could be. And it was this very like leave no trace kind of attitude. And then once I went to forestry school, I started to learn more about these ecosystems and to realize that actually these forests that I thought of as being these utopian, perfect, pristine places were actually deeply troubled, deeply imperiled, deeply degraded and altered. And that there was stuff we could do to help them. And that they weren't just in every case going to be okay if we just left them alone. And we needed to find a way to like take these actions to care for them. You know, experience talking about birds. I have this experience with birders all the time where I'm out with these birders, you know, and they say something like, oh, this bird species used to be here and it's not here anymore. And that's like the end of the conversation, right? And what I say is, what do you want to do about it? You know, are these environmental changes that we experience just things that we need to accept? Or can we find a way to actually take action, you know, and to help?
Well, so that's a great segue to my next question. So, you know, you describe your book as a love letter to the forest and to biodiversity, and that's very clear in reading it. But you say something else very interesting, where you say that the book is also dedicated to a world that doesn't yet exist. And mm-hmm. I'd love to ask you to say a little bit more about, you know, what do you mean when you say that?
Yeah, I think one thing, a lot of the book is centered around my experience of my own land, which I call Bear Island, and which is this forest that I bought 7 years ago. And at the time, it was this forest that for me was just sort of the symbol of everything that was wrong with the world, forest that had every problem that a forest could have. And what I really wanted to do was just kind of to stop the bleeding, you know, and to bail out the boat. And what actually happened was I discovered that as I managed this forest and as I did things to attenuate some of the issues it was dealing with, like non-native invasive plants, like deer overpopulation, that what I discovered was a forest that was not just sort of restabilized, but which was actually rediscovering a capacity for life, which was had been missing from this landscape maybe for centuries, right? A lot of our forests on this landscape are deeply degraded. And a lot of that is a legacy of a big one is like this wholesale land clearing that took place in our region in the last 300 years, where basically, if you're listening to this in the Northeast, basically every forest you've ever been in was cleared in the 1800s. And many of them are really young and simple, missing many of these critical pieces and parts that forests develop over vast expanses of time. And all of those things are habitats. All of those things are things that enrich our forests in a variety of different ways. And so I was like, whoa, as I sort of attenuate some of these threats and stressors, and then also work to reestablish some of those qualities in our forest, things like forests that are multi-generational, you know, that have many different sizes and ages of trees, and have things like deadwood on the ground, which I know we all think of as this is just like a big mess, you know, that offends our aesthetic sensibilities, but was actually is a foundational structure, a habitat for thousands of species of living things, and important to forest hydrology, important to building soils so that future generations of trees can grow. As I started to establish those things, I was like, we are rediscovering this forest capacity for life. So I mean, when I say that this is sort of a love letter for a world that doesn't exist yet, that's part of it. So in an ecological sense, it's a realization that if we're willing to take action and to make these really bittersweet and challenging decisions, like cutting trees, which if it doesn't hurt you to do that, you probably shouldn't be doing it. And I do it and it hurts me, and I do it all the time, right? So there's a that is true in an ecological sense, but then also what I also wanted to speak to is this world that doesn't exist yet, in the sense that we have an opportunity to also rediscover a relationship with ecosystems, which is different. Where what I was really responding to when I wrote the book was realizing that we have this idea that there's this dichotomy where either we treat these ecosystems, which on which all life depends, including our own, like commodities, and we totally exploit them, you know, just value them only for the resources that they provide us, or if we love them, we leave them alone and we do nothing. And in my mind, both of those are really relationships which are completely alienated from ecosystems and which do not allow us to do anything to try to actually build a world that's better, you know, and that actually allows us to like take action to correct some of these issues, all of which are human caused. And so I was also sort of visioning, reimagining not just of forests themselves, but also of our relationship to them, which I believe would yield benefits for us culturally, ecologically, economically, in every way as species that are dependent on ecosystems.
Exactly. Well, if you're just tuning in this morning, you're listening to Nature Nuggets, and we're talking to Ethan Tapper, who is a forester in Vermont and just wrote an amazing book called How to Love a Forest. And something, Ethan, that you're referring to now, you know, kind of one of your core thesis, it's sort of this cognitive dissonance that people can experience where you walk out into the forest anywhere in the Northeast, you know, if you go into the Catskills, Adirondacks, you're up in Vermont, you can have a lovely experience. There's this, you know, beautiful, the trees are lush and green, but it can be a little park-like. And, you know, actually, when we think about, you know, what is a healthy forest, often if you do find the little pockets that are left of old growth, sometimes people have a reaction like, oh yeah, it's messy, it's scary, it isn't kind of have that park-like openness. And so one of the things you're just referring to is, you know, the active role or even the responsibility as humans, that the forests that we see today are deeply impacted. And the fact is that they always have been. You know, even for millennia, the Native Americans actively managed forests in many, many ways. And then now, since European, you know, colonization, everything that we see is drastically impacted by humans. And so at this point, you know, leaving the forest alone, you know, is still a form of management. And so a lot of what you talk about and advocate for is taking a thoughtful, active approach, you know. And so I'm curious, you know, and there's values embedded in that, right? So we have values. What are our values? What do we want from the forests? What is our responsibility to the forests? And so I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, yeah, what are the values that we want to prioritize? And then what does that mean in translation to, you know, how we manage the forests?
There are, it's such a great question. And you know, one of the things that I talk about in the book is how all this stuff is really nuanced, right? So there are a lot of these questions that I could tell you a little soundbite. That would be the answer. But really what the answer is the process, right? Of asking these questions and answering them as best we can and adapting and changing. And that is another thing, in addition to like these actual actions that we take, that is another thing which can make people really uncomfortable. Like, processes can be messy. And it is as true in our communities, right, as it is in ecosystems. So one of the things that I really value when I think about valuing when I manage ecosystems is biodiversity. I think that we often misunderstand biodiversity as being something that's like nice to have. Isn't it nice, right, that you can go out and you can see those swallows eating insects over your head? Isn't that nice that we can go to a, you know, wetland and see a yellow warbler, or we can go to a you know, a field edge and see a chestnut-sided warbler, or go to a cattail swamp and see a bunch of red-winged blackbirds? You know, like that, we were like, oh, cool, it's nice to have biodiversity. Actually, when you study these ecosystems, you start to understand that biodiversity is what makes them work, right? So like that is, it is beautiful, and it is also deeply functional. Like it's actually something that we need to have. There's one of our conservation thinkers, you know, now whose work is pretty old, but still relevant, Aldo Leopold, talks about, you know, keeping every cog in wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering, right? So if we wanna, we know that there's stuff that we need to change, but we need to make sure that we're, as we do that, that we're keeping everything, right? We wanna hold this whole ecosystem, which we have to have the humility to understand that we will never fully understand these ecosystems and their every piece and part. And we have to not let that paralyze us. Right? Like, this is a thing that happened to me when I learned birds, where I realized that I went from just hearing something that is like in air quotes bird song my whole life to realizing that what I was actually hearing was dozens of species of birds that are each completely different. They're each utilizing different pieces and parts of the forest in different ways, different species of trees, different areas of structure, understory, midstory, overstory, canopy gaps, deadwood, tip-ups, like all, you know, all of these different things in different ways. And when you start to embrace the complexities of ecosystems, it can be very scary because you don't want to do the wrong thing, right? But if we do nothing, that also doesn't work. So, yeah, so what we try to do is to think about solutions that protect our biodiversity broadly. And I should define biodiversity. The definition that I use is from E.O. Wilson, one of our great conservation thinkers, biologist, myrmecologist, actually, ant scientist, who got me excited about biodiversity. And he defines biodiversity as the variation between species within an ecosystem. So all the different species that are present in an ecosystem, variation between ecosystems across our landscape. So different types of ecosystems, different types of natural communities that may support different species, and the genetic variability within each individual species. All that stuff, when we put it together, is what we call biodiversity. And it's complex, right? And it's impossible to say, you know, to tell you briefly how all these things fit together. But we know that these are all the things that we want to at least aspire to protect. So when we think about that, I think that that's a really good sort of first thing that we want to care for, is just making sure we have all of the pieces and parts. And if there are pieces that we're losing, that we need to take action to attenuate that. And then the other thing that we can think about is thinking about, you know, broadly, what are the habitat types, the forest types, the structures that are underrepresented across our landscape. One thing that you see when you study birds is that there are birds that are very strongly correlated to many different habitats. And when you create those habitats, the birds show up. And when those habitats aren't there, they just go somewhere else or fade away. And so, you know, when we also need to think about, you know, both within an individual forest and across our landscape, what habitats are we underrepresented? And if there are things that we can do to create those, and thus to create habitat for all of the elements of biodiversity, birds and everything else, what are we going to do to create those habitats?
I love, one of the things that you don't shy away from is really making some, you know, analogies between the natural world and human communities. And, you know, as a Radio Kingston is, you know, deeply committed to showcasing and uplifting, you know, the broad diversity of the community that we live in here. And, you know, I love, like, embedded in what you're talking about, you know, resilience is a concept, you know, that in a climate changing world, and you know, with all the stressors and threats that our ecosystems face, complexity itself is a form of strength and provides that resilience to whatever threats may come. And so, that active management of understanding that forests, if you let it just come back from the trauma that it's faced, you might get a monolith. You know, there's certain species that'll dominate, and so actively making a choice to clear a patch of forest or to take out certain trees so that the ones that need the light, you know, will grow, is a form of creating that complexity, which in turn results in that kind of resilience, which in turn invites in species that, you know, wouldn't have a place if that wasn't the case. So I really appreciate the way that that you point out those parallels between the human world and the natural world, because it's clear that they exist.
Well, yeah, and it's a tricky line to walk, right? Because one thing that I also see is, like, people mythologizing forests, you know, and like positing that they're these utopians and all the trees are like collaborative and never competitive, they are, like, forests, and using the word symbiosis, interestingly, so symbiosis or symbiosis does perfectly describe what forests are, but it also doesn't mean what people think it means. So people use the word symbiosis, they conflate it with the word mutualism, mm-hmm. which is actually a type of symbiosis, which is a mutually beneficial relationship between organisms. And, you know, when people have this sort of like mythologized vision of forest, they think it's just all mutualisms. Everybody's taking care of everybody else. And in reality, what symbiosis means is any close relationship between organisms. And it contains mutualism, which is a beautiful form of symbiosis, but also parasitism. One third of the animals on Earth are considered parasites. And that's a relationship in which one species harms another species, right? Also commensalism, where one species benefits from this relationship and another is unaffected. Competition, predation, all of these are forms of symbiosis. And when we think about symbiosis in this way, it perfectly describes what forests are, which is complex, right? And I think that when people, like, you know, have these analogies from the forest to describe our communities, they often will use these like utopian analogies, right? We should be like the forest, every tree supporting each other, everything fitting exactly in its place. And I just think that that's such an unrealistic expectation for us to have for a forest, which is just not true for forests, but also for our communities. Forests do have lessons to teach us about our communities, but I believe that it's the fact that they're messy and they're complex and they're based in processes which are not, you know, the end point of which is not always clear, and there may not be an end point, right? And the process itself might be the thing, right? So one thing that I've tried to do with How to Love a Forest is a lot of times in the conservation community, we do these management actions, right? We'll involve almost all the time something that people don't like to see. So we're like cutting trees, for instance. Who could believe that the cutting of a tree could ever be something that's positive for forest ecology, but it really can't be used in the right way. And you know, traditionally people will come back at us with these sort of, with these responses that we would term as these emotional responses. These beautiful forests has been ruined. These beautiful trees have been cut. And then in the conservation community, we would have to respond with these unemotional scientific responses, right? And with How to Love a Forest, I was like, you know, there's a reason these emotional, you know, arguments are really powerful. And that's because we're emotional beings. And I don't know how in the world we're supposed to help people understand, you know, the deep layers of how we're trying to care for these ecosystems and all the species that depend on them if we don't meet people like where they're at, right? And so I tried to, with How to Love a Forest, kind of create this emotional argument that speaks to not just like an emotional argument for not doing stuff to care for ecosystems, but for taking these incredibly bittersweet and complex and at times counterintuitive actions. And it's a fine line, you know, because one thing we don't want to do is we don't want to anthropomorphize forests and trees, because, you know, we need, they're not like us. They're very different, right? They have things that, like anything else, we can think about and can, you know, give us some insight, but they're also their own thing. And so that, and that's what makes them beautiful. So let's let them be what they are and learn from that, rather than seeing that we have to like turn them into this whole other thing.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. It you know, we are emotional creatures, and every choice that we make, even if it's a choice to not do anything, is an active choice. And I appreciate your thoughtfulness and, you know, taking it requires a level of intimacy and understanding to make informed choices about how we're going to shape the landscape. And I look forward to returning to that. But before we do, we're going to take one more moment to hear some messages from the community.
Hi, I'm Kristen Kessler from the City of Kingston's Department of Health and Wellness. We'd like to invite you to Kingston Eats, the citywide Harvest of the Month campaign, where celebrating healthy local food is fun. This year, we're focusing on the abundance that is grown near us in the Hudson Valley. Look for upcoming Harvest of the Month like potatoes, beans, asparagus, and more. As always, there will be menu specials at local restaurants, free produce at participating local food pantries, free cooking workshops, and fun school-based and daycare activities for our youngest community members. If you can't make it out to a special event, you can also find Kingston Eats online on Facebook and Instagram at LiveWellKingston and using the hashtag KingstonEatsFresh. You can get more information on participating locations when you click Eat Well at livewellkingston.org.
Radio Kingston.
Many voices, one community.
It's music.
Hi, I'm Annie Nero. Join me Sunday afternoons at 4 p.m. for Annie's Theme.
It's music.
Each week, we'll come up with a musical theme. It could be anything at all, a theme loosely related to something going on here in Kingston. We'll stretch that theme so far that it's unrecognizable, but the theme will always be there.
It's music.
Like a jazz improvisation that goes so far out but returns to its standard melody. There's no genre of music, just a theme. Annie's Theme.
It's music.
Sunday afternoons at 4 p.m. here on Radio Kingston, AM 1490, FM 1079, and anytime at radiokingston.org.
Welcome back. You're listening to Nature Nuggets on Radio Kingston, and I'm your host, Laurel Sutherland. And I just was informed by our sound engineer, Adam, that it just reached 70 degrees outside today, which is a little startling, but also an urgent invitation to get outside. If you have plans, maybe think about changing them, because today is a day to go outside just on your foot, on your feet from your front door or out into the woods if you can. But excellent day to get outside. We are talking today to Ethan Tapper, who's a forester and naturalist from up in Vermont, and he just published an amazing book called How to Love a Forest, The Bittersweet Work of Tending a Changing World. And I want to say that His book is featured prominently and available down at Chicory Naturalist here in Kingston. Our co-host, Chris Baker, has an amazing shop and community center down in the Rondout, and you can get this book down there. And also want to say that if you just caught a slice of the program and you want to hear the whole conversation, all of our episodes are archived on RadioKingston.org under Nature Nuggets. You can also find us on Instagram. We have the handle is HV Nature Nuggets. And I will say, too, that Ethan, you know, you have accomplished something kind of remarkable as a lifelong nature nerd, you know, reaching kind of, you know, mainstream audiences, you know, can be a challenge. And through your various platforms on social media and, of course, now through this book, you know, it's amazing. I think you have 50,000 followers on Instagram. And so, you know, that kind of communication where you're able to translate the sort of complex topics and like the intimacy with the landscape into something that people respond to and you know, want to follow is really a great gift. And so I would encourage folks to you know, if you're on the socials, look up at How to Love a Forest, because you regularly post things. And you know, you're very active. You often are working with a chainsaw and you know, out in the forest, which can be controversial for folks, but I think you make a very strong case about the thoughtfulness and the way that you're doing that. And so, you know, we could talk for hours. We just have a few more minutes. And so, I'm looking at a long list of questions, but I have a very specific one with our just remaining 3 or 4 minutes that we have, is to challenge you about, to introduce us. What is a wolf tree?
Sure. Great one. So a wolf tree is a tree that in our vernacular here off in the Northeast, and there's other names for these trees, was at one time standing alone in the middle of the pasture. So in How to Love a Forest, I have a chapter in the book, chapter 3, which is about legacy. And what it does is sort of follow one of these wolf trees along on this incredible journey that our landscape has taken. So I have this experience when you're walking through the woods and you see these big ancient trees, often with these big lateral branches. The reason that that tree is so old and that it has those lateral branches is because that tree was growing alone in the middle of a pasture when all this landscape was basically all agricultural land, maybe for 100 years, 150 years, 200 years, where you are. And I often have the experience of visiting those trees in the forest, seeing this relatively young forest all around me, and thinking about what that tree has experienced in a way, like what, you know, that tree might have been a sapling in an old growth forest that grew up for hundreds of years with livestock grazing around it, and then watched in air quotes, this young forest rise sort of precipitously around it. And so I thought that it would be a fun way to sort of describe this journey that our landscape has been on by describing one of those wolf trees. There's a bunch of different ideas for where that name comes from, and actually posted a video, one of my better viewed videos, that's about wolf trees, and people have talked about all these interesting other like cultural things about it. So look up my What's a Wolf Tree video on Instagram or Facebook or YouTube, and you'll see all kinds of more information about the naming and why those trees are there for folks. But yeah, there are these really interesting cultural features, which are also markers, the changes that our landscape has undergone over the last few centuries.
Yeah, it's really neat. I'm glad we had a chance to fit in that question, because I know that I didn't have a name for it, but I know that I've seen that, you know, walking around in the woods here and in the Catskills, where there's just one tree that stands out and it's huge and it doesn't, it's a, feels like a message from the past, you know, how did you end up here? And we also have, you know, a lot of stone walls in the forest around here. And you know, for a long time, I just thought, what are these? It seems so odd in this forest that might be 60 feet tall, and learning that a lot of times those stone walls were built to separate sheep, because when mm-hmm. the landscape was a pasture, they're stone, so they lasted. They are a moment in time frozen. Well, we've reached the end of the hour, but Ethan, I really appreciate the work you do, and thank you for taking the time to join us. I hope you have some good adventures in the spring upcoming.
Thank you so much for having me, Laurel.
Completely, oh, hey.